My name is Albert Ho. I am now a practicing lawyer, having in the legal practice for over 40 years. I had served in the Legislative Council of Hong Kong as a legislator for over 20 years, and I stepped down from this public office in 2016. I also served as the chairman of the Democratic Party of Hong Kong, which is relatively the largest, opposition party in Hong Kong, for the years 2008 until 2012, for 6 years. I'm now still active in social movement, and currently I'm the chairperson of the Hong Kong Alliance in Support of Democracy Movement, which is responsible for organizing the candlelight vigils in the past many years, where, over, 100,000 people attended, to commemorate June 4th. And I'm also the chairperson of a group, an NGO, helping the human rights lawyers in China. And I'm a local, born, and educated, person. So Hong Kong is my home.
Okay. So just to bounce back on what you said, Albert, you've obviously gone through the transition from the UK government to the Chinese government. So my question is very straightforward. Do you feel that Hong Kongese, like you, always had in the back of their mind suspicion of what China would want after the handover?
Now, put it this way. Hong Kong had, throughout the past many years or decades, even the whole century, been playing the role as a refuge for people who would like to escape from the authoritarian rule or regime in China, in mainland China. That is the role Hong Kong has been playing. During the time of the of the reign of this Kuomintang, during the 30s, many communist, underground people, workers, communist members, came to Hong Kong to work underground, in the unions, and many of them who were being warned in China, they came to Hong Kong as a refuge. Now, come earlier, even during the Qing Dynasty, before the revolution, which turned China into the republic, many of the revolutionaries and activists also used Hong Kong as a base. So the British rule Hong Kong in such a way as to afford Hong Kong people freedom, a certain degree of freedom. And then, a lot of activities, inside the civil community, the British, do not really want to interfere into the daily life and the custom and the way of living of the Chinese community. So that is the situation for many years.
Do you think the British ruled fairly here?
The British rule
fairly?
Oh, yes. They managed to keep the place under, orderly governance. It's peaceful and orderly, although there is no democracy, throughout the years. Mm. Even up to the date of handover, there is no basically a democratically elected government. And even, before the transition, to the handover, before the transition, there was absolutely not a single elected member to the Legislative Council. So you see, the colonial government is true that never give Hong Kong, a democratic institution. Although there were certain elected elements in the municipal council, the urban council and the regional council, which has very limited authority over certain municipal affairs. But the reason being that China had always, after the communist takeover in 1949, very strongly resisted to the introduction of any democratic institution in Hong Kong. Now, in history, in the 50s of the last century, the Governor Young, you know, who was posted in Hong Kong, you know, by the UK government, initiated a Young reform, seeking to enlarge the power of the municipal council to give it more power over housing, health, public health affairs, and education. And then the municipal council would be partly or even substantially constituted by elected members. You know, that was the plan of the Young reform. Mm. But it was, you know, subsequently aborted. And according to record, it was mainly due to the resistance or objection from mainland China. So throughout the years, you know, in the 70s and 80s, especially when the question of Hong Kong's future, you know, that is the Sino-British negotiation or the future, you know, that question emerged. There were a lot of people who concerned about the future of Hong Kong after the handover, which appeared inevitable. They all wanted to have a government locally elected and rooted in Hong Kong, so as to ensure that the government can take care of our internal affairs within the realm of autonomy, high degree of autonomy, promised to us under the one country, two system. So throughout the transition from 1984 to 1997, you know, there have been strong movement for a democratic transition. But eventually, you know, the Chinese government promulgated the basic law, limiting the pace of development to a certain degree. Mm. So up to 1997, we have only 1/3 of the legislature being returned by election. Mm. And then from 1997 to 2007 or 2008, the Legislative Council was only constituted in such a way that 50% were from democratically elected members, and another 50% by what they call functionally elected members. These are special franchise, and the structure is to ensure that the governor, that the establishment, namely the chief executive and the Chinese central government, would retain a sure majority in the Legislative Council. And also the chief executive throughout the years are elected by a small circle of people comprising 1,000, initially 800 members, but now, you know, 1,200 members. But structurally, it is dominated by pro-Beijing members.
Now, just really quickly, before we get to the protests that started happening recently in Hong Kong, can you tell me a bit about the economy and the strengths of the Hong Kong economy?
Okay.
And why that might, well, in my mind, seems to be envious from China to a certain extent as well.
Now, in the 50s and 60s of the last century, you know, Hong Kong is mainly a place as a haven, you know, for the refugees from China because of the very cruel and repressive, you know, domestic measures in China, leading to a massive persecution of ordinary people, especially class enemies. So throughout the 50s, a lot of people escaped to Hong Kong. So there is a lot of migrants from mainland China.
Not only China as well. I've noticed maybe all the other areas as well have moved.
No. Mainly China.
Mainly China.
Predominantly China. Okay. Especially in early 60s because of the famine, you know, when, you know, 40 million people died. Mm. 35 to 40 million people died in China. Of course, you know, hundreds of thousands of people fled to Hong Kong. Now, the living condition, of course, is poor. You know, many people have lived in squatters, you know, in the very congested areas. But by and large, you know, people were not starved. You know, there are a lot of people starved to death in Hong Kong, although the conditions is bad. The British managed to maintain order, managed to feed the people, manage to afford certain jobs, and then the police are overall effective. Okay, the people didn't have much expectation except a place, you know, to give them, you know, peace. Okay, to give them protection of their personal safety. There were internal conflicts between the pro Kuomintang, that is the civil, the Kuomintang, who is now, you know, in exile in Taiwan, and also the communist. But, you know, but in the 60s, there was a very big strike and then protest in 67, obviously due to the bad living environment. And then, of course, there's also certain police corruption, and then, you know, after all, you know, because it's there is no way for the people to ventilate. Although it's basically still an orderly and safe place, you know, but the people feel that something has to be improved. The living standard ought to be, you know, not so bad, ought not to be so bad, but there is no place for them to ventilate their view, because the colonial government only have agents, you know, they only have people serving as the agents to rule, to keep in contact with the Chinese community. So there is more or less, the Chinese community is entirely living on their own, and the British has their own community, their own way of life, you know, and barely, you know, there was a comprehensive and deep, in-depth understanding of how the people really lived, although basically the society is in order, on the face of it is okay. So there was a large-scale protest in the 66, and then followed by 67 and other big and very violent protests, and that was triggered by the Cultural Revolution in China, and the local revolutionaries made use of the discontent of the grassroots people. Now, of course, eventually, orders were tackled. The police eventually were able, with the understanding from the communist leaders in China, they eventually they successfully tackled the riots, and many people were arrested, and eventually they were brought before the court. Now, after that, the British, for the first time, they instigated a very comprehensive social investigation into the cause of the 66 and 67 riots, especially 66, which was triggered by a fare increase of the ferry service in Tsinjiazhui. At the time, it's only 5 cents. 5 cents increased, and yet there was a riot. And they felt that a system ought to be in place for the government to take the pulse of the people. So instead, then they set up the Home Affairs Department, and then there were local home office, you know, this community office set up in various districts, and then community service officer were, which is of direct junior director grade, were put in place in each administrative district, altogether about 18 to 19 throughout Hong Kong. Okay. Now, one other thing which is very important is that the governor at that time, Lord McNichols, he knew that time has come for the government to be more responsive to public needs. They know that society has changed. You know, when everything is back to order after the riots, people have more expectation, and they have felt that, you know, it's not easy to tackle when there's such large scale unrest and riots. So he introduced large scale program, welfare program into Hong Kong. That is very important in the history of Hong Kong. Public housing program, which started to house many people living in rooftop, in quarters, in the hillside, and very poorly, you know, housing conditions. All these people were gradually moved into public housings, when this program was put in place. They put a lot of money, and they continue to open a mission of the university to the grassroots people by extending a large amount of grants and loan to the grassroots people. So in my time, I was immediately Hong Kong U in 1971. I come from middle income, middle class family, but many of my classmates and colleagues, you know, they come from very poor family, squatters, you know, the fathers of workers in factory. And of these people of my generation, many of them are now very successful business people, professional people, you know, in the society. One of the
You're a product of that welfare. To a certain extent.
I'm not, because I'm a middle class.
Yeah.
My family can afford it. But for many other people who are more successful than I, they are top surgeons, top professors, top businessmen, and many of them are in top of the professional management hierarchy. You know, very successful, living in the most luxurious department, much wealthier than I. but that needs to change. So it's a big scale of mobilization, what we called social mobilization. Now that is also that also happened against the background when Hong Kong underwent a very fast, rapid, a large scale economic growth. Okay, during that time, because Hong Kong started to develop industries. Okay, light industries. And that was, in those days, attracted a lot of labor, absorbed a lot of labor in Hong Kong. And in our days, you know, we had the wig industry, toy industry, watch industry, garment, you know. So every family, even poor family, they can have, you know, jobs, you know, at home to give them some more extra income. They can work at home, and of course there are a lot of workers working in factories. So there are many factories in Hong Kong. So in the 60s, especially 70s, 80s, that made Hong Kong very successful as an industrial center. But gradually, after the opening of China, I mean economic liberalization, then some of the industry gradually, from the 80s onwards, gradually moved to China. Okay, many factories moved because of the, in order to save, in order to make use of the cheap labor in China. So eventually in the 90s, Hong Kong industrialists actually employ more than 2 to 3 million workers in the Delta region. Now, then you would ask, then the Hong Kong economy would be hollowed. But that is not the case, because these people earn money in China by setting up factories, but the investment made them earn a lot of returns, and all the money was taken back to Hong Kong and invest in other industries, such as the service industries. So especially Hong Kong, and then you know, the property market become very prosperous, and then the banking industry also went very well developed, and then finance, you know, tourism, logistics, because Hong Kong is still being used as an entry port. Now, one other edge Hong Kong has over China is that we are free from any embargo of the Western world. Because during those days, there's still what we call the COCOM. We're still imposing a lot of restriction on transfer of high-tech, you know, products to China. So as I know it, the Chinese government set up, you know, local industry through some patriots, Chinese patriots, you know, as trustees, as agent for China. So we see some semiconductor company being set up in Hong Kong. In fact, it's for China. And although the machine cannot be moved into China, but they do set up people to learn. And sometimes some reverse engineering were done to examine how the machines work, how the computers work. So, and then, you know, and then, you know, profit is not the main thing. It's learning, you know, the high-tech, you know, in Hong Kong, you know, making use of Hong Kong as a free city, free from the COCOM's embargo. I think that is most important. And then there's a lot of management techniques, skills, you know, and then especially knowledge about the financial market. They all acquired from Hong Kong.
So we're going to bring it back to now and
yes.
the situation. Sorry, I'm
taking it is okay.
We'll just finish up on that.
Yes.
So you've been having protests for quite a few months now all
yes.
across Hong Kong.
Yes.
Do you feel that's reactionary to a more strict Beijing policy on Hong Kong?
Yes, the people feel very discontented, very disappointed, very frustrated, and now very angry.
Mm.
The young people feel very angry
mm.
Because, you know, after the subsiding of the Umbrella Movement, you know, the people feel that they have been deprived of the right to choose their own government through dual universal suffrage. And then they see that Hong Kong is continue to face a lot of pressing social problems, okay? Including, particularly, disparity between the rich and the poor, and then, you know, there are unfair competition between many Hong Kong people and mainland people, because many people coming to Hong Kong, they are very resourceful, rich, you know, they set up enterprises in Hong Kong, they dominate the market.
Are you saying there's a certain favoritism happening?
Obviously,
yeah.
Because of connection. You know, everywhere, you know, people can rely on connection, family connection. You know, a lot of, you know, cronyism, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people, and then the housing price, you know, making the young people really have no hope of purchasing their home. You know, all this, of course, are economic factors, have gone further than that. They said this is only the consequence. The cause is deprivation of their basic rights. They want their freedom to be protected. They want their dignity to be protected. They want a vote to make sure that the leaders would be responsible for what they have done and be responsible to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the... So it's more than material demand, okay? And, you know, in the last 2 years, you know, Carrie Lam, the chief executive, still thought that she had a very successful ruling, you know, record over Hong Kong. Especially he was able, you know, to brought the leaders of the Umbrella Movement to jail, to put them to jail. He was able to disqualify, you know, elected legislators for defying the oath. And then he was able to put in place this co-location legislation, which is, you know, strongly criticized by the legal community for violating the basic law. And then he could able to do anything she wanted without much open and substantial resistance. So she thought she can do it. She can push through anything, even though there were occasionally strong protests inside the Legislative Council, you know, during the legislative process. Yet all these legislators, what they call these rebel legislators, were being kicked out from the chambers, and two of them are even being prosecuted for obstructing the electrical assistance in seeking to remove them in order to bring the house back to order. You know, it's the legislator who is supposed to perform the function. They were prosecuted for obstructing these people, this assistant, for removing them. So there is obviously the people were very angry. Now, of course, the breaking point is this extradition bill. We all know how serious the consequences, because it would, you know, tear down the firewall, eventually making, you know, all the Hong Kong people vulnerable, you know, to the repressive regime in China. And we all know that there is absolutely no rule of law in China. okay, and freedom, liberty, you know, and the rule of law are definitely, you know, not respected in China. You know, you don't need to be educated to know about this. You know, we live in Hong Kong, it's so close to us, we have seen many victims, you know, we have seen how they cruelly treated their own people. You know, that's like beating the dogs behind the door. So this time, you know, the resistance is quite unanimous among the community, from the business sector down to the grassroots people. You know, and it's known to people who had experience of crossing the border to work in China. They heard what was happening every day, you know. But even though there were so strong, the voices are so strong, Carrie Lam turned a deaf ear to it. He tried to push it through, give us 20 days consultation for such a bill, you know, which has never been presented before the LegCo, knowing its complexity and sensitivity. So it was deliberately withheld from the legislature in the last 20 years. Yet she saw fit to push it through within a month's time or 2 months' time. The LegCo members done their best. They were not able to do it because of the because they use everything they can by the majority of members who are pro-establishment. So these people just carry out orders, you know, keep their eyes, you know, closed, and just vote in whatever way they were directed. So the people are so angry, and then we have the march.
Yes.
In April we started with, you know, 100,000. Initially is about 10,000 in May. In April. In April we have over 100,000. And then in the 9th of June we have 100,000. And yet she's still on the late evening of the 9th of June, Carrie Lam still said that we are still going ahead. Although 1,000 people have voiced out their objection. So that is the 15th of June, where the young people came out to block the LegCo, and then the meeting was aborted because there are so many people, you know, put the LegCo building under siege, and then the police opened fire. So, and on that Saturday, Carrie Lam somehow was instructed to suspend the process, but on the next day there was 2 million people. Then what Carrie Lam did was just to offer a half-hearted apology, but without responding to the other demands, namely, you know, a total withdrawal of the bill, and then calling for independent inquiry, granting amnesty to the protesters. And of course, what is even worse is on the 21st of June, July, you know, on the 1st of July, people intruded in LegCo. They want to manifest their anger, but they do it in quite a principled way, in that they only aimed at destroying some of the facilities in LegCo without, you know, destroying any other things such as the library, you know, and other things that are really that should be preserved and should be protected. So the act is targeted and somehow principled. So that only showed the anger, and quite surprisingly, you know, most of the Hong Kong people, although they may not agree to it, but they said that they understood it. Okay.
So
that is the situation.
Okay.
So it's now the police and the protesters are now in a very, very, in a very confrontational situation, and there is a lot of mutual hatred and hostility. The young people hated the police very much, and the police were somehow caught in the middle. They are disciplinary forces, and they were sometimes they have to do their job, but very often they used unnecessary and excessive force against the young people. They accused the young people for using violence, but in fact what they did is no more than throwing and barrier, throwing rubbish to the police. And it may be a few pieces of brick, but you know, that is far from, you know, what we knew as really violent riots. No, they were not. And many of these people were very young students. You know, of the 44 people who were prosecuted yesterday for riots, you know, in 2 days after they were arrested, you find that nearly all of them were born after the 90s. Okay, many of them were students.
Were they students here or?
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Just really quickly, I just have two more questions.
Yes.
We've noticed recently, you know, a lot of violence, not necessarily dished up by the police, but more by gangsters and tribes being involved.
Yes.
Where are they coming from? And is the police actively, encouraging them to stop the protesters?
Now, you judge by what happened on the 21st or July, where protesters wearing black shirt and civilians were indiscriminately attacked by people wearing white shirts who were apparently well organized and they had a clear target of attacking the victims. Now, actually, this plan of attack in Yunnan, where you know the indigenous villagers and the triads are often mixed together, and they were, in fact, many triads, you know, had their centers, had their own quarters, you know, their place inside the village. This is traditionally this is how they do things. Actually, a few days before the attack, it was already widely, you know, spread out in the internet that there will be attack. And then some pro-establishment and rural leaders, and even legislators like this Junius Ho, said openly that that we Yunnan, you know, this is, you know, a very traditional rural town. We have to stick to our rules and then teach the boys. Okay? We got to teach the boys. And so they tell the people to buy some, what they call the rods, okay? Baton. Keep it, and then at appropriate time, come out and teach the boys a lesson. Give them a hard time, you know, strike them hard, such that they know how they should behave. Now that is already on the internet. Some of this matter were reported to the police. The police said they were aware of this, they will respond to it, and subsequently we knew that they had set up a center, okay, to monitor the situation. But on the 21st, at around 9 o'clock in the evening, 200 white shirt men, you know, with rods, with sticks, with baton, they started to beat young people on the street, especially those wearing shirts, and tell them to go home, tell them to behave. Now, so it's only a few strokes, you know. It's not a very severe attack. That is in the 9 o'clock. And then people started to call the police. And that is how the police said that they were jammed, you know, with calls. But actually, that is precisely the time where they should intervene. But nothing happened. And then at about 10:30, these white shirt people intruded into the West Rail Station at Yunlong, and they had black shirt people and some civilians. Initially, just verbal argument. Of course, the black people were very angry. And then they thought that they never visualized that they would even openly attack them in the station where there was a lot of camera. But yet they wear this mask. This white shirt immediately put up the mask, rush into the station, and beat the civilians indiscriminately, including the black shirt protesters, apparently protesters, very severely. So the one of the legislator, Lam Chok Teng, he was hurt badly, and many others. And all this were filmed by reporters and some other people. Now that is the first round. And then subsequently, that is 10:30. That is second attack. And then at 11 o'clock, this white shirt people retreated, and then the police came. They were maybe 30 to 40 policemen. And the people were so angry, and of course they accused the police, they blamed the police. And the police retreated without doing anything, without even trying to help these people to go to the hospital. And then half an hour afterwards, although the station has already been closed, the white shirt people came back again. They forced through the gate. They pushed open the gate and went inside and beat the people again. And all the police disappeared at that time. So that is the third attack. Many people again badly hurt. And then the police came back again half an hour's time. And they and the people told them that they were now hiding inside a village near the police station. The police, went inside the village and talked to the people. At that time, there's still many white people carrying them rods. And the police didn't care. And after they went inside and talked to some village leaders, they came out and asked the white people to go. And then they take their vehicles and left. And obviously, there were photos showing that these white people are taking lots of them. And the police were working side by side with them. There was a lot of photos. And the police said that, we have no evidence to show that these white shirt people are the attackers. And the fact that they wear shirt doesn't show that they're criminals. And then they didn't even know when did they arrive, how long were they delayed, how many calls they have. At the same time, all the police stations in Yunlong were closed. And not only could not ring 999 for help, police stations were inaccessible. You can't reach the police. So that's why there's at least strong evidence to show that there's collusion.
Yeah.
But even less than collusion, we would say that at least there's indulgence of the police. For this
five
people to attack civilians.
Albert, I'm just going to finish with one last question.
Okay,
because
sure.
It's been...
It's all right. No.
What is your ideal outcome of the current situation between China and Hong Kong?
It's getting worse and worse, the situation. It's even more tense as the days go. And Carrie Lam seems to be totally unable to function. She avoided public appearance. She didn't answer the press. She had nothing to offer, not even any message to comfort the victims, to restrain the police. So she is more or less become a puppet. And many people have the reason to believe that she's no longer the chief really ruling over Hong Kong. But it's obviously by some people giving her direction from time to time from Beijing or through Beijing. And judging from what was said in the state, from the spokesman of the State Department, it seems that the Hong Kong government was instructed to stand firm, and they would use tough law, including prosecution policy, to bring all the troublemakers, rioters, to justice. All those people using violence to what they call justice, that is to put them in prison, okay, and make them serve long sentence. I think that is really a very, very bad move, and it's going to hurt the young people. It's going to hurt Hong Kong. It's even going to deepen the wound that has been severely inflicted on Hong Kong. Okay, but obviously they have no indication of accepting some of the even very moderate proposals actually supported by Hong Kong people across the whole community, from the business sector to the grassroots, from the civil servants to the professional circles and to many other people, you know, and all the other sectors, coming out to say that something ought to be done. Mm. And the setting up of an independent inquiry is definitely the most effective way to resolve it and to seek reconciliation.
Do you think, last question, do you think Hong Kong's economy history has a lot to offer China in where it's going as a country itself?
Sorry, Hong Kong...
Do you think with Hong Kong's history, its economical strengths?
Now, Hong Kong has been accepted as a very important international financial center serving the need of China. And it's said by one of the top leaders in China, Mr. Han Jing, he said that the role of Hong Kong was irreplaceable, is irreplaceable, and will continue to be irreplaceable in the foreseeable future. Because we have a very a strong foundation, the rule of law, a historic background, you know, and then there are so many international investors with vibrant societies, freedom of information, effective civil service, you know, peace and order, you know, most important of all is the legal system that has been functioning well, okay? And a good track record. But all these are now being undermined. Mm. All this good reputation will be undermined, especially when the judiciary has been repeatedly used by the government as an instrument of repression. And the judges are trying hard to try to alleviate, you know, this problem, you know, where the judges, in addition to the policemen, are being forced to repress people exercising difference of opinion. You know, there is a certain limit where the judges really would not like to go beyond. Mm. So it's very stretching, you know, the credibility, it's stretching the judiciary, you know, to such a degree that I believe that even the judges are feeling very bad about it. So let's see what is going to happen now. What is coming in the next few days would be a massive, you know, campaign of non-cooperation, and there would be peaceful resistance movement trying to stifle the operation of the government. You know, they would do it in a very innovative way that you cannot think of in the past. All this was done by these young people. They make decisions over the internet. Mm. You know, they are very determined to force the government to respond. They say that if we give up this time, there will be no hope for Hong Kong. And then they will say that after all, you know, we have nothing to lose.